Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coronomics, The Spectator's series on stories from countries turned upside down by COVID-19. I'm Kate Andrews. Each week we bring together a panel based around the world who give you an inside look at what's happening outside their windows. This week I'm joined by Silvia Ciarilli-Borelli, who's reporting from Rome and Milan correspondent for the Financial Times, Jennifer Creary, who's managing editor of the Hong Kong Free Press and reporting from Hong Kong, and Nick Gillespie, who's reporting from New York City and editor-at-large for Reason magazine. Welcome all. This is the last episode of Coronomics after our two series. I'm especially excited to be joined by the three of you because we kicked off the series together back in mid-April when all of our countries were in the height of lockdown. We spent series one talking about different political, economic, cultural stories coming out of our countries. And then in series two, we brought in some more representatives from around the world. But the three of you, Nick, Sylvia, and Jennifer, have been at this since the beginning. And so today, rather than looking at specific news stories from our countries, I want to do more of a look back and think about where we were when this first started in April, and certainly where we are now, and probably most importantly, where we're going in the future. So I'm going to ask the three of you to start to sum up where you think your country was at back at the height of lockdown in mid-April, where you are now, and where you're going. Jennifer, I'm going to start with you in Hong Kong.
Yeah, so you're right. You mentioned that the coronavirus had kind of taken a backseat. So it's interesting because at the beginning, we spoke about how there was a lot of residual anger towards the government over last year's protests. And that was very much transplanted onto COVID-19 and the way that the government initially handled the pandemic. And we saw a lot of kind of familiar protest tactics manifest in terms of trying to pressure the government to, for example, close its borders with mainland China. We saw kind of medics go on strike, as well as, you know, shopping mall demonstrations against the government. But a lot has happened since then. So the virus kind of came to a lull for several months, during which, you know, local and central authorities seized on this opportunity to crack down on political dissent while the world was distracted by the pandemic. So most notably, Beijing's enactment of the national security legislation in Hong Kong, which essentially criminalizes acts like secession, sedition, terrorism, collusion with foreign forces, and so on. But it's interesting to see what's happened now, because it seems as though, although there was this sense that health authorities had, you know, largely slammed the lid on the spread of the virus and that cases were pretty much going to be limited to just imported infections from Hong Kongers returning from overseas. And, you know, this response has been impressive, but it seems as though those celebrations were kind of premature because now the city is experiencing this third wave. So for the past few days, authorities have recorded this exponential growth in the number of coronavirus cases with an unknown origin. It basically means that they're neither imported from overseas nor do they have any kind of epidemiological link with any other confirmed case. And, you know, public health experts are saying that this latest wave is probably the worst yet. And this has really, you know, raised the possibility of asymptomatic carriers in the community, or at least those with very mild symptoms. And health authorities have essentially said, look, we probably can't contain the spread of the virus entirely. You know, clearly these tactics aren't watertight, but we can try and slow it down so that our healthcare system doesn't collapse in a week or two. And there is a concern that, you know, Hong Kong may not have the resources or the facilities to accommodate all of these potential cases. Bearing in mind all returnees to Hong Kong have to undergo a 14-day quarantine, this has remained in place since the beginning, since we first started this podcast. And so, you know, as we're speaking now, authorities have just introduced the most sweeping anti-epidemic measures, like compulsory mask wearing on public transport, and also reinstating a cap on the public gatherings to no more than 4 per group. So this is a very big difference to what was happening before. So it's interesting to see this transition between, you know, Hong Kong being this city, this model for how to tackle the coronavirus, to now seeing it slip into what is essentially a third wave. So I guess there's no template solution for stopping COVID-19. And I think Hong Kong, if anything, is this kind of cautionary tale of how there's no one-size-fits-all solution to breaking the local chain of transmission, no matter, you know, how tightly controlled your environment is.
You know, Jennifer, I think what's amazed me the most about Hong Kong is that it has handled COVID-19 in the midst of this massive standoff with China, the security law being brought in, these massive rallies and protests in favor of democracy. It's handled the virus in a time of such political tension. And as you say, even one of the countries that's handled it best, Hong Kong, isn't exactly out of the woods yet. But I do find it very inspiring because Hong Kong is still so far ahead of where we are, say, here in the UK and elsewhere. And I would say that it has done so, facing real adversity that other countries just haven't had to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. And given its geographical proximity to China, it is extremely impressive how it's had just over, I think, 1,400 cases and 8 deaths in a city of, you know, 7.5 million residents. And that is really impressive. And we spoke about this in previous episodes in which Hong Kong has experience with the SARS outbreak in 2003. And Hong Kongers were very much understandably traumatized by it. And that's why mask wearing is so ubiquitous now. And people haven't really kind of resisted wearing masks. It's pretty much generally accepted. If anything, it's quite unusual to see someone without a mask out in public. And you will kind of see people requiring them or asking them to put one on as a result. And I think there is large kind of public acceptance towards that, even though the government and the health authorities have handled the virus relatively well. I don't think that has done anything to improve the government's public image, you know, particularly with the current political crisis. And now with the enactment of the national security law, some people may feel like they can't say anything against the government, even if it is to do with, you know, criticism about the virus. So there are these two kind of parallel issues, the virus and the ongoing political crisis, and they're very much intersecting.
Sylvia, when we first spoke back in April, Italy was in a much stricter lockdown than the UK was and than America was. I mean, you weren't even allowed out for a stroll around the park. In recent podcasts, you've been talking about how Italy has reopened in many ways, has become much more liberalized since its strictest lockdown, but that there's been this growing north-south divide and that there's frustration that perhaps parts of Italy didn't need to react as severely as other parts did. Can you give us an update as to how things are different than when we first spoke now, and also what you think the future holds for Italy, and particularly different regions of Italy that perhaps are now feeling more tense than they previously were?
Yeah, so as you said, when we started the podcast, Italy was trying to control the spread of the virus, and it was the country in Europe that had been hit before any other one, really. And the main task for the government was trying to prevent the spread of the virus from the north, where the epidemic started on a national level, because everyone realized that hospitals in the poorer south could not have coped with the numbers that the northern part of the country was dealing with. And in hindsight, everyone agrees that extreme lockdown measures actually did work quite well to contain the spread. And I think even the critics of those policies, who at that time were focusing on the economic impact in regions that hadn't seen such a severe outbreak compared to the northern part of the country, now agree that the total economic shutdown and those extreme lockdown measures were the only thing that really allowed the government to contain the virus, including up north, where numbers now are very, very low. Many Italian regions are COVID-free, so they aren't experiencing any new cases, which is a really good improvement compared to a couple of months ago, where you had thousands of people being hospitalized each day and hundreds dying. So I think right now the issue as we expected and as we discussed previously on the podcast, is the economic impact of the shutdown and whether this current government, which actually was a fragile coalition government before the pandemic and is now even more litigious, is going to be able to manage the economic fallout from the pandemic. And of course, because southern Italy is the poorer part of the country and it is also the part of the country whose economy essentially lies on tourism and on international tourists and people going there for holiday, the question is, what are those regions like Sicily or Campania, which is the region that contains Naples, or Calabria, which are very poor regions that have a rural economy that actually thrives during the summer thanks to tourists? What are they going to do now, and what is going to happen to those businesses now that tourists, especially international tourists, are nowhere to be seen? But on the other hand, even in the rich north, the economic impact is now becoming pretty obvious because the manufacturing companies or the suppliers that export their products to, for example, Germany, that work with the auto industry in Germany, or, for example, the fashion industry supply chain and the apparel factories that, you know, produce little tidbits of the wider supply chain for the fashion industry and are largely small and medium enterprises, are really suffering the economic impact of this global shutdown. Many of these companies, including in the north of the country, work with the United States and with China, so they've really seen their orders plummet and their revenue is in free fall because many countries across the globe are still battling with the pandemic. So I think the debate here in Italy has very much shifted to the economic impact of the pandemic and whether Italian authorities are going to be able to manage that impact and are going to be able to intervene with subsidies and with policies that actually help entrepreneurs carry on with their business and save jobs. And I think the answer to that for right now is quite uncertain. And everyone is betting on September to really offer more answers and sort of crystallize the situation in terms of the politics of the current situation, but also the ultimate economic impact.
And Sylvia, broadly speaking, does Italy have a better relationship with the European Union now, or was it better before it went into lockdown?
I think that's a great question, and ultimately the answer to it will depend on how all this talk around the so-called Next Generation Fund, so these billions of euro that are going to pour into different states that have been impacted by the pandemic, is going to go down in the end, because there's a big debate between Northern European countries and Southern European countries as to whether these funds should be grants or loans. Obviously, Italy does not want loans, but it's asking for grants, whereas Northern European countries, who have always criticized Italy for having high public debt and governments that don't really focus on structural reforms that much, are saying that these should be loans. So there's a big debate internally as to whether the European Union will live up to expectations and ultimately give Italy this money as grants as opposed to loans. And I think the shape of this aid coming from Brussels and from EU partners will also shape the future of Italy's European relations, and also the Italian public's opinion, perception of the European Union, because of course populist parties here are still very strong, and although the main one is now in opposition because of the fragility of the government I was mentioning, there is always a sense of instability. And you know, commentators, at least domestically, always believe general elections sometime soon are a possibility. So I think it all depends on the economic impact and what the European response after the negotiations and the summer is going to be.
Sylvia, thanks for that. Now, in terms of who really ranks at the bottom here, I'm going to let Nick perhaps fight or challenge me a little bit. I'm going to make the case for the UK coming second to last, and perhaps he'll make the case for America coming second to last, or he'll agree it's at the bottom. My case for the UK is that actually things have been handled pretty badly here. When we all first started talking in mid-April, the UK was just a few weeks into lockdown, and it has been heavily criticized for going into lockdown late. But the reason that the UK government decided to hold off as long as possible is it was thought, at least across Europe, that the Brits would be hardest to keep inside, that you could only do it for a limited period of time, and eventually people would say, enough is enough, we don't care what the rate of infection is, we don't care what the impact is, we're coming back out. That turns out to have been a gross miscalculation. The Brits are some of the hardest to pull back out into the offices, into the shops. There has been pushback every step of the way as the government has tried to liberalize the restrictions, as people are just saying, we're too nervous, we're not ready to do it. Now, as a result of that, and actually many other things connected to this pandemic, our rate of infection does remain very low. A lot of this has to do with the fact that we did successfully flatten the curve, although very sadly at the expense of elderly patients who were kicked out of hospital and put into care homes, at the expense of cancer patients, thousands upon thousands of whom have had their treatments delayed, which we know is going to have very big consequence down the road. But we do seem to have things relatively under control. I would still have to caveat that and say that our track and trace scheme is extremely piecemeal. It's just about managing. We don't have a functional app in the UK yet because the government thought it was a better idea for bureaucrats to try to create one from scratch than it was to use the tried and tested framework of the tech giants to actually come up with a successful and decentralized scheme. So we're still relying on human contact tracers to do all of our local lockdowns. We have started to do some. The city of Leicester is in a quasi-lockdown right now compared to the rest of England. We learned today that there are some very, very localized lockdowns happening on a farm or in a factory, which is really what should be happening, but it is not at all obvious that going into the autumn, if there were to be a second wave or a third, as Jennifer mentions, Hong Kong is kind of experiencing, albeit numbers still very, very low, relatively speaking, that the UK could really handle it. So, Nick, I'm not thrilled with the UK's performance since April. We've been quite slow out of lockdown. People haven't been feeling confident to get back out there. I think part of that is true just lack of confidence, and the other part does rest on the government shoulders that they haven't necessarily put the schemes in place to make people feel secure to do so. But our rate of infection is low, and the virus does not seem to be spreading week on week. It does seem to be going down, which is why I'm making the case that we get to come second to last. In America, we know that that rate of infection in many states is still going up. But I give you the floor.
There's no question that the novel coronavirus has completely upended American society. And I would not necessarily even talk about it in terms of the number of deaths or confirmed cases or anything like that. What has happened between, you know, March and now is a national disruption that goes not simply to healthcare issues. And, you know, we've got about 135,000 deaths. They are coming down on a daily basis, or have been. The places that were hit first and hit hardest, including New York State, or especially New York State, and a couple of northeastern places around it, New Jersey and Connecticut, deaths are starting to decline, infection rates are declining, hospitalizations and things like that, whereas other parts of the country it's picking up. But because this kind of crossed wires or crossed paths with a whole series of national protests over police brutality and race relations, as well as the way that the federal government and state and local governments handled the economy, we were in the middle of a presidential nominating or presidential election season. We are having a discussion about who America is in a way that is actually unprecedented in my lifetime. And I'm old enough to remember the Cold War, the kind of twilight of the Cold War, which we didn't know was the twilight at the time, but it, you know, people were really concerned about the possibility of nuclear annihilation or global domination by the Soviet Union, to the end of the Cold War, to the war on terror, and right now. And in the United States, I've never lived in a period where as much is up for grabs when it comes to talking about what is America, what does it stand for, and what kind of country it is. And Kate, to go to your question about you know, people coming out are back. I've just returned from a couple of weeks in California, which was one of the states that had been somewhat lauded for its early and, in the context of the United States, extreme lockdown, seemed to be successful compared to New York. Now is in the midst of locking everything down. Americans very quickly went along with, you know, a very fast shutdown within a week or two of the economy and of our right of kind of moving around, doing business as we like, walking around as we like. And I think that staggered a lot of people because nobody was expecting that to be the case in the United States. Now we're looking at an economy that tanked to a point where we had 15% official unemployment. That's come down a little bit, but now every economist is saying we're looking at a double dip recession over the next several months. So I'm not an American exceptionalist. I think we have done a poor job of dealing with this, but often for reasons that other people might disagree with, which is I don't mind that the decentralized responses that different states, cities, and the federal government put into place, but there has been a massive failure of government at all levels to come up with, first and foremost, good information and reliable information, including reversing that information in real time, policies that follow from that information, and then any kind of discussion about what is the larger picture here.
Interesting how sort of the battle for a country's soul is reflected on both sides of the world, because Jennifer, I think we were hinting at that before. Hong Kong is going through something similar, but of course for very, very different reasons. Do you think there is a mirror there between what's happening in the States and Hong Kong? Has the virus just accelerated these massive, almost philosophical questions that have to be asked when a country is teetering on the brink?
Certainly in Hong Kong, I mean, it seems as though every kind of new government announcement, whether or not they are loosening the restrictions to tightening them, every conversation is undercut with a question over whether or not the government is deciding to do this because they want to suppress people's freedom of expression, because that is a pertinent question on everyone's lips with the enactment of the national security law. And so it seems like we can't really escape this political narrative. And even on Monday, when Chief Executive Carrie Lam made the announcement that the government was going to impose these sweeping new anti-epidemic measures, which were kind of more extreme than they've done so in the past, almost immediately reporters' questions were about why was the government doing this? Was this to do with a kind of political motivation? Because, of course, in September, we're going to see the legislative elections, so the elections to elect lawmakers to go to the Legislative Council. And so it seems, again, like every conversation we have about COVID is ultimately a political one.
And Nick, it's not fair to draw a direct comparison because of the major issues around free speech and, you know, simply the right to vote in Hong Kong that they're fighting for, which arguably aren't happening in America. But I would say, I mean, everything I'm reading out of America suggests that you just can't talk about anything, whether it be the virus or social issues, without that political identity seeping into it. Should we just expect to see more and more of that related to the virus and otherwise leading up to the election?
Oh, absolutely. And I agree. I mean, Hong Kong is fighting for its existence as an autonomous or semi-autonomous region. The United States is not in that same kind of existential battle, but it is one about a shift in what we have believed. Wesley Yang, a writer and essayist who I think is deeply insightful on this, is talking about America's looking for a successor ideology, as he calls it, to kind of the understanding of common American identity that existed through the Cold War. And then there were shallow versions of it later after the Cold War, when there was a kind of techno-optimism in the 90s, and then another kind of unification around the War on Terror, neither of which stuck. And we now are an incredibly fragmented country where there is no national narrative that knits us together. And in fact, all there is a series of identities on the right and the left among blacks and whites, you name it, that are kind of at odds with each other. And then that gets compounded by the fact that government at all levels, and whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, you are calling for massive increases and have enacted massive increases in spending without any gesture towards ever reducing spending levels again. We've pumped trillions of new dollars in a couple of months into the economy from the government, all of which is borrowed. And people are figuring out how much more to keep doing that for the foreseeable future. It's a serious debate. To be frank, it's not as serious as what Hong Kong is going on. But one of the things that I think when the tide of Corona goes out, you know, what we'll be left with is the fact that science and policy were so deeply politicized across every level. So it's, you know, it's a statement of who you are if you wear a mask, not what's on your mask, but if you wear one or if you don't. We had epidemiologists who one day were saying you have to stay indoors because contact with other people will kill everyone in America. The next day they were saying, you know, it's okay if you go outside to participate in a protest over the police killing of George Floyd. We are left with a country that has reduced its credibility among all of its constituencies to the absolute lowest ebb that it could be. And it's going to take a lot to come out of that. And certainly, you know, as the presidential election gets going, and it's between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, neither of whom inspire anything like confidence or fellow feeling, we're going to be in a long slog for a long time. So if any of you other countries want to become the dominant power in the world, this is a good time to flex.
For Italy, this is just the last straw, I think. It's not just an issue of this government, which of course has many flaws and is very fragile, but it's just a question of very weak politics and weak governments and a public system that in many respects does not work and has not functioned properly for decades. And up until this point, extra debt and extra spending was the only way politicians knew to sort of attract voters and to keep their electoral promises. I think that is to some extent going to have to change right now, because this is a situation where this government and Italy will have lots more money to spend, including because European Union rules are suspended. But the point is knowing how to spend that money and invest it well so that the economy does get back on track and jobs are created. So I think this is really an opportunity for this country to change everything it's done so far in terms of economic policy and social policy. But it's also a very risky game, because if politicians and public authorities aren't able to live up to expectations, well, then the situation could deteriorate and the economic crisis could become worse. And, you know, after three recessions in one decade, it's going to be very, very hard to get the country back on track.
It was interesting that Nick brought up how the COVID crisis across the world, but especially in the West, is being funded. We've all become very familiar with debt finance spending and just going into debt further to fund the promises of today, not really thinking about tomorrow. But Sylvia, I think you've made very clear today and in previous podcasts that Italy's big question is increasingly an economic one. And maybe this is it, that the issues that face countries before, whether they be political in the case of Hong Kong and also the US, or an economic one in the case of Italy, who's been in the news for really a decade now, and since the financial crash, in terms of its economy, its debt, its finances, its unemployment, and how to get out of that. COVID's really just exacerbated these conversations. So for some it's political, for some it's economic, but either way, it's the burden that your country held on its shoulders before the crisis that's just totally come to the forefront.
If I can add to that, I mean, in the United States, it's a little bit different, partly because the United States is the largest economy on the planet, and the U.S. dollar is still the reserve currency. But we are building on almost a 40 or close to 50 year record of contributing to the national debt, to deficit spending on top of deficit spending. And we are now approaching levels of debt that haven't been seen since World War II. You know, it'd be one thing if we had been running a tight ship up until now, but we hadn't been. We had been spending far more than we took in for decades, and now we are, have absolutely blown through any, you know, semblance of constraints. And I think in the United States, I mean, the way that I read it and the economists that I kind of believe most about this say that large persistent national debt, when you're running a debt that is 90% or 100% of the economy for more than 5 years in a row with no sign of slowing down, it creates what some have called a debt overhang. And that reduces future economic growth by about 50% year over year. So instead of growing at 3%, you grow at 2%. And that's what we've been seeing in the United States before this all hit. And now it's going to be even worse. And I think in the United States, what we're looking at ultimately, absent some kind of change, is what Japan has been going through for the past 20 or 30 years. They entered their lost decade in the 90s because they refused to cut spending and the size and scope and spending of government while propping up zombie businesses. And the United States has been doing that at least since the economic crisis, the financial crisis. And I think it's a real issue because nobody wants to talk about that, given that we have COVID and race relations and this kind of more ephemeral or spiritual question of what does it mean to be an American. In America, we're going to be paying for this for the next quarter century, at least.
That's a point really well taken, Nick, because here in the UK, I think there's increasing feeling, those looking at the Treasury's books, that the issue isn't necessarily this one-off spend or hopefully a one-off big spend on the COVID crisis, but even after a toted decade, essentially, of austerity policies, the UK government didn't come anywhere near actually sorting out its policies on healthcare and pension reform and public liabilities, which are going to have to be paid back or reckoned with at some point. And it's just completely unclear where the money's going to come from.
If I can wax a little historical, kind of, you know, Hegelian or something like that, and I apologize in advance for that, but, you know, I think in a lot of ways what we might be witnessing here is the end of a kind of long 20th century. If you take the 20th century as beginning with the Bismarckian welfare state, where the government was recognized as the main provider of kind of health, education, and welfare, and that had a phenomenal run. And it seems like, at least in the West, the ability of governments to be able to responsibly pay for that without ultimately either clogging the economy in terms of innovation and entrepreneurship and capitalist enterprise in line with the revenues that they can do without tanking the economy, I think we've outstripped that. And what we're looking at here is not simply a couple of bad years or whatever. We need a shift out of the way that we think about government that is not unlike what happened after World War I or World War II. We need a new paradigm that is going to be radically different than the ones that we're used to or that we grew up with.
Well, hold on to that idea, Nick, because it may well be part of your answer in the last question I'm going to ask you. But I have two questions for all three of you as we wrap up what has been one of the most insightful podcast series I've had the opportunity to be a part of. I've learned so much from all of you. The first question I want to ask you is, what do you think each of your countries did well during the height of the pandemic? And that can be something that the government did, but it doesn't have to be. It can be a social response, a community response. Jennifer, I'll start with you. Name one thing that you think went well.
I think what Hong Kongers did best was they acted in unison in terms of their community response. For example, when the outbreak first came to Hong Kong, they immediately lobbied the government to impose stricter measures. And as we mentioned previously, the medics went on strike to urge the government to at least restrict some of its entry ports or close some of its borders with China. And I think, again, this is to do with this strong sense of solidarity that Hong Kongers have with one another, although, of course, political crisis has very much brought divisions to the fore within communities, within families. But Hong Kongers are largely able to act together to fight for a common cause. And if anything, the political movement is evidence of that. And the coronavirus has further demonstrated that. And so with the wearing of face masks and sanitation stations and really trying to get the community to act together, you don't really see people resisting any of these measures, only when it comes to public gatherings because they think that it's a curb on their freedom of expression. But I think Hong Kong has fared pretty well because of the way that residents have reacted and because they have this muscle memory from SARS back in 2003.
Sylvia?
I think the response for Italy is quite similar. Italians have responded quite well, and they have shown a great sense of responsibility, especially because the lockdown measures were extremely restrictive right from the beginning. And you had many situations where families were separated, with kids being stuck up north because perhaps they studied in Milan, or the elderly being separated from the rest of their family. And we know that Italians highly rely on the elderly, for example, for childcare. But suddenly, Italians just turned into a very responsible population, following the rules. And even now, 4 months into this pandemic, with lockdown measures having been lifted in supermarkets, indoors, in shops, you really see people wearing their face masks, regardless the heat and the fact that, you know, we're at 35 degrees now and it's full summer. And I think this has been quite surprising. Perhaps this is thanks to the government's restrictions and everything that was repeated over and over again by public health authorities on television, because I think there was a point where the population was terrorized, including because of these numbers of deaths that soared every single day for 2 months. So I'm sure there was a component of fear. But at the same time, I think the fact that people largely did abide by the rules and the lockdown measures were extremely restrictive really avoided the situation really getting out of control and really helped it get back on track, at least in terms of the pandemic and rate of infections at this point in time.
I'm sensing a common theme here, because I was most impressed here in London and really across the UK, at the very height of the pandemic around early April, when the virus here was at its peak, when its death toll was at its highest, the National Health Service and the government coordinated to launch a volunteer app in which UK residents could sign up to volunteer in their local area. And that could be from delivering medicines to helping people get to their medical appointments to even just making phone calls to check up on people who were self-isolating, who might be elderly or alone. But some of the things that these volunteers were asked to do would have been putting themselves potentially at risk of getting the virus at a time where we just knew very, very little about it. And they were hoping to get about 250,000 people signing up. And within 72 hours, 750,000 people had signed up. And I think it just speaks to, you know, a quiet bravery here in the UK that people were thinking of others, even when we just knew so little about this virus and were potentially willing to put themselves in harm's way. Nick?
I will, I guess, cut a little bit against the grain and say what was good in America is that a lot of people didn't follow the rules, or more specifically, people in government were very quick ultimately to change regulations that were clearly getting in the way and were counterproductive. So you had the people at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention who quashed early attempts in Washington State to allow broader types of scientific testing, getting out of the way, and the FDA, which governs these things, loosening things up a little bit. States like Massachusetts relax rules on medical professionals from other states having to get licensed in Massachusetts. The TSA, which governs airline safety, reduced some of its rules at kind of like lower levels. Cities relax their ordinances against allowing certain types of drinks to be served and walking around with open containers, what it's called. So one thing that Americans did well was they reduced regulations and also then created new ways of doing business and whatnot. We had very fast adoption rates of using things like Zoom, you know, having workers work at home and things like that. If the United States prides itself on something, and I think this is often a false pride, it's that we want to constantly be innovating and kind of, you know, we're the stepchild of Enlightenment ideas and Schumpeterian creative destruction. There's something there. And that's the highlight among a general tableau of just absolute stupidity on the part of government and many American citizens.
Last question to all of you. We keep hearing about this new future, not just the new normal, people wearing masks in countries where they otherwise didn't, sanitizing your hands before you walk into a shop where you can't touch anything, but a genuine overhaul of society and economics and politics and culture as we know it. I'm asking for a bit of a prediction here, and maybe we'll reconvene in future months or years to decide what did and did not come true. But I'd like to know from each of you, do you think that the future is going to look dramatically different in your countries? Is there going to be this overhaul? Or once COVID is truly under control, will we go back to same old, with a few lessons learned? Jennifer?
Yeah, so I think in Hong Kong, at least, it's very difficult to predict what will happen because, for all we know, the situation may continue until the end of the year and even past that. But I think there will be a radically kind of different mindset. I keep mentioning this, but after SARS, it took Hong Kong quite some time to return back to what is normal. But Hong Kong did learn lessons from it. And as a result, they were able to tackle COVID in a way that was much better than any other country. And I think that Hong Kong is still going to do that post-coronavirus. But I think the mindset of Hong Kongers, because of all that's happened with COVID and the political crisis, Hong Kongers are a lot more jaded as a result, but it will be very difficult for them to really express this. And I think while there has been largely support for the health authorities and how they have been able to tackle the pandemic, Hong Kongers will, their mindset towards the government is radically different. And I think while there will be appreciation for medical workers, there will definitely be skepticism towards the government and any kind of measure that they take to put a lid on this virus. But I think in terms of how Hong Kong will be different after the pandemic, I think many Hong Kongers will be wary about, for example, coughing on public transport. I'm pretty sure this is the same in other countries as well, but I think mask wearing will continue to be quite widespread. But Hong Kongers, as they've demonstrated in the past, have been able to learn from their mistakes, and I'm sure they'll carry those lessons forward with them after the virus passes.
Sylvia?
I think there's a very big appetite in Italy to go back to normality, at least to go back to normality in terms of social contact and going out and going on holiday to the beach. And we've actually seen a bit of this in these past few weeks already. While people in cities are wearing masks, as I was saying earlier, there are lots of people who are now starting to book holidays. They're going out for dinner. Potentially they're sitting outside, but I have seen people really resume their social life and their social contacts. I think what might be different is the way people work, because many companies and businesses, not just in Italy, I think this is true in other parts of Europe at least, have actually understood that they don't really need their employees to travel or to be in the office every single day, and that it works quite well for everyone, including for employers, to keep them at home and have them, you know, hold meetings in video conference or via Zoom. So I think that is something that will change going forward. But largely, I think Italians are really dying to go back to how life was before the pandemic.
My colleague and editor-in-chief, Catherine Mangum-Ward, in a recent podcast said, you know, what she has given up on is the idea of a return to normalcy. And I think that that captures a lot of what is going on in the United States. People would like to get back to, you know, the before times of all of this, but it seems kind of unlikely. On March 17th, which seems a million years ago, I wrote a piece that was headlined, How the Coronavirus Might Kickstart the 21st Century. And it was kind of trying to get a silk purse out of a sow's ear by talking about how the quick adoption of a lot of online techniques for work, for education, for shopping, which we have been predicting in the U.S. and at Reason and myself personally since the mid-90s with the rise of the World Wide Web as a mass medium, you know, is finally coming around. And that has definitely happened. There are going to be more people working either full-time or part-time or flex-time from home. So certain types of social functions are going to happen either online or not at all. Education will always be using more online technology than it was before. You know, that's all kind of good, but it's also been shown or revealed, at least in its early stages, as a pretty weak imitation of life. And I think it'll have to get a lot more robust to be satisfying. And I guess, Kate, in response to your larger question, life will be different and it'll be substantially different, but it will also be completely recognizable from what it was. And I'm curious, and unfortunately I don't know all of the people in my family who experienced this are dead, but what it must have been like for European and North American countries and Asian countries after World War II ended, where you had a decade of depression and then the privations of a war economy with harsh rationing, etc. And then after that, in the United States at least, and I think this is broadly true of Western Europe, there was an enormous boom after a certain period, and the future happened kind of all at once, but also in a kind of understandable way. And hopefully we will see something like that in a positive sense, as opposed to the mirror image of that, where our economies just kind of sputter on, but are literally or figuratively out of gas, and they're just coasting until finally friction brings them down.
Well, Nick, let's try to take the positives that you speak of and cling to them and carry those with us in the months to come. It's been a real treat to be joined by you, Jennifer, Sylvia, and Nick today, but a special thanks for all the podcasts that you've appeared on for Coronomics. It's been wonderful to learn from you and hear your stories from countries truly turned upside down. I look forward to getting more updates from you, maybe on other Spectator podcasts in the months ahead. If you enjoyed today's podcast and you want to catch up on previous episodes of Coronomics, you can subscribe to the Spectator's podcast channel. And whilst this special series, Coronomics, is coming to an end, we're excited to announce that a new economic series, which will also be hosted by myself, will be hitting your podcast app in the weeks to come. If you have any ideas about academics, economists, politicians, or just particularly insightful people that you'd like to hear from about the UK economy, the world economy, and in particular how we're going to pay for all this, please send your suggestions to podcast@spectator.co.uk. Thanks for listening.
The Spectator's podcast now have a newsletter. Sign up for free at spectator.co.uk/podcast-highlights to get the Spectator's podcast highlights in your inbox every Monday.